I have to admit, harmonica added a lot.
Episode of the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and once again, we have another fascinating topic tonight. But before we jump off to that conversation, we've got our usual announcements to make. For tonight's show, like always, I would love to hear from the listening audience. So send your questions and comments to me via email at giascott@exogenynetwork.com. You don't need to worry that I'm going to give you your email address or your name out over the air, and I'm not going to spam you forever and ever either. I don't have time for that, so it won't ever happen. And that means just don't be shy. I know you have something on your mind that you would love to have the answer to. And if you're listening in on a podcast, go ahead and send me those questions and comments, and I'll try and get an answer for you. Now, tonight's guest is Dinah Federer, the author of Chasing Normal. Dinah, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience as well as where they can find out more information about what we'll be talking about tonight?
Okay, great. Thanks for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here tonight. I am actually a triple agent in the field of disability. I was born with a neuromuscular disease, and that has been with me for all of my 49 years. At the age of 35, I acquired a secondary disability, which was a nerve pain condition. So I've lived the experience of growing up with a disability. I've lived the experience of acquiring a disability. And I worked for over 20 years in the field of disability as a vocational counselor, helping people with disabilities find jobs. So I've sort of seen the world of disability from many, many sides and many, many facets, and I wrote a book about it called Chasing Normal, A Guide for the Newly Disabled and for Those Who Love Them, because when I acquired my nerve pain condition, I went looking for material to help me adjust and to help me through the grieving process, and I didn't find anything in a form that spoke to me. I didn't find anything that was helpful to me. So when I sort of stabilized from that secondary issue, I wrote a book. Then it was the kind of book that I would have liked to have read when I was going through the process. So that's why the book came into being. And for more information about it, actually my website has just changed. Site is www.chasing-normal.net. So feel free to go there and read all about it after the show, because we're going to have fun talking about it now.
Yeah, you know, for a lot of the audience members, they may not realize that 3 years ago, in about a split second of explosive pain, I went from being absolutely normal, where I did everything and I was active and camping and hiking and you know, doing stuff, to somebody who was disabled. And, you know, having been down that road, and then a year ago, I reached that magical state that they call maximum medical improvement. And, you know, denial, I mean, really serious denial. It was like, no, I don't believe this. So, you know, another doctor. And when you get this repeatedly, you're kind of left with no options but to say, okay, I guess I really am going to have to live. What has happened for me is not only do I have pain issues with a lot of headaches and stuff, but I've lost the use of my right arm to any great extent. And that sounds really minor until you go to get a plate out of the cupboard, because I'm right-handed. You go to get a plate out of the cupboard, you go to lift a pan off the stove, you go to make, cook, because I do a lot, I've always liked cooking. You go to try to set up a tent, try to carry something. I mean, you know, I run into this wall all the time, and, you know, there's still days when I like, you know, would just like to sit down and scream, and trying to adapt to it has been not the easiest thing in the world. And I'm not the only person that's encountered this. We have an aging population, and I'm told as we get older, we don't heal as well, and we're more likely to end up with permanent issues than we are when we're younger. Well, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. But at the same time, more and more people have encountered that than ever before.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, the baby boomers are aging. And as people age, just like you said, as people age, functioning decreases. It may not even be an event. You know, it might not be an accident or an injury. It might just be a loss of functioning that occurs over time that, you know, maybe you don't go camping for 5 years, and when you finally do go camping at the age of 65, you realize, oh, my gosh, I can't walk as far. I can't carry as much. You know, I ache now if I'm sleeping on the ground. I didn't used to be like this. I used to be much more resilient. And so that even loss of resiliency can be devastating to come to terms with. So, and then if in fact you are somebody who has a loss of functioning coupled with chronic pain, chronic pain adds a whole other dimension into what
yes.
people deal with. And it's a devastating, devastating facet of the disability experience that requires a whole different set of coping skills. So, yeah, there's a lot out there that people may not realize until they actually experience it. And then as they experience it, it really is like peeling an onion. You just have to go through layer after layer after layer as you come to terms with each stage or each part of the issue.
I think one of the things that I find most frustrating is, you know, I have one of these invisible disabilities. When you look at me, you don't realize that there's anything wrong with me. And, you know, there's times when walking, you know, 100 yards, it may as well be 100 miles. I mean, it's just incredibly difficult. And, you know, go to things like check out at a register. It sounds like a simple thing to do. But if I'm having a really bad day, you know, I'm fumbling with my left hand trying to get things out of my purse and my wallet and take care of it. And then they go to hand you back change. Well, you know, I have to put this stuff in my wallet so I can put out my left hand for it. And people get so impatient with you.
Yes.
And it just, or there's other days when, you know, because I sometimes will have balance issues and I'll like stagger. People react like I'm drunk. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, there's nothing wrong with me. You know, I just don't walk so good some days, you know. You know, and people don't realize that there are so many invisible disabilities that you don't really notice or that you can misinterpret. I mean, things from slurred speech, that doesn't mean that you're on drugs or alcohol. You know, it can be lots of other things that can cause that to occur randomly as well. Or the staggering, or the inability to walk, even though I look perfectly fine. Or when I'll ask for help with something because it's heavy or bulky and I can't manage it with one arm. You know, I have some use of the left arm, or the right arm, but, you know, not a whole lot. And then, you know, bulky and heavy things become, you know, this huge obstacle. I may as well be trying to lift up my entire car as try to manage it. You know, I do find that people are very, they're fine with people in wheelchairs or on crutches or something that says obviously this person has an issue of some sort. But with the invisible disabilities, which are actually the most common, they have much less tolerance.
They do, you're right. And it's the unfortunate thing is, number one, we're not very well educated as a society. You know, when it comes to societal etiquette, nobody talks about it. You know, nobody discusses it. Nobody goes over it in school. Parents really don't talk about it unless maybe their kids have a classmate that has a disability. And even then, my guess is that it's very minimal. I can tell you that, as someone with a very apparent disability, I'll be in grocery stores and you know, kids will point at me, either I'm on my crutches or now more regularly I'm in a scooter. Kids will point and say, what is that? Why is she like that? Why is she in that thing? And parents become mortified and, like, grab the kid and pull him away. And in my mind, I'm thinking, wow, you are missing a teachable moment. This is a moment where you can educate your child and teach your child to be understanding, compassionate, inquisitive, all of these things that they are naturally. Rather than encouraging this, you're inhibiting it, and it's sad. So I think part of it comes from that as children, nobody's really prepared decently to deal with disability. I think the media, unfortunately, speaks to perfection rather than disability. I also think that we really have a problem in our culture with people being very sort of narcissistic in that, you know, it's my time, it's my schedule, you're interfering with my schedule, you're too slow, you're in my way. People have just sort of lost common courtesy and empathy, I think. You know, I think that by and large as a society we're very impatient and pretty judgmental. And if you're not moving at the speed of light, people will get very frustrated and nasty. And I think it's unfortunate. So I do these kind of shows, I do these kind of interviews as sort of my way of giving back and encouraging people to really look at things differently and to, you know, as you're viewing the world, try viewing it through the lens of compassion. Try filtering everything that you see through the lens of compassion and maybe ask yourself if you hear someone slurring their speech or if you see someone staggering, gosh, might they have MS? Might they have a disability that is causing them to have to work so much harder at what they're doing? Is there something maybe I could do for them? Or, you know, if you can't, at least be kind and stay out of their way. You know, these kinds of things, I think, are things that we could do very easily. They're not going to cost us a dime. We just have to really try and filter information differently. And, I think we need to use the filter of compassion because we're not really taught that, unfortunately, but I think we can teach ourselves, and I think the more we talk about these things, the better we'll get at it.
Well, in addition to, the American society is notorious for its tendency to worship youth and physical perfection.
Right.
Now, while, you know, they're very admirable goals, you know, to be as perfect as you can be, for some of us, we're never going to look like a model or a TV star. I mean, it's just not going to happen. And I think my first, you might say, wake-up call about my own vanity even was about 25 years ago. I had a car accident where I went through the windshield of a car. Obviously, my face bore the brunt of that impact. And, you know, when I was released from the hospital and that those first few months, you know, my face was, to put it mildly, kind of messed up. And, you know, at first you had all these scabs and stitches and whatnot, and then the scabs are fading and you have real vivid scarring at first. And people's reaction was kind of, it was amusing at first, but I soon sort of lost my sense of amusement about it. They would start staring, and then they would realize they were staring, and then they would look away. And then when they would look away, they would not acknowledge you again, which sounds, you know, sort of strange, but it meant that going to stores became an exercise in humiliation because I couldn't get clerks to wait on me. Mm-hmm. Going to get my hair cut, I actually grew my hair long again, you know, after that one haircut, because they acted like they were going to catch something from me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and scars are not contagious. You know, it's like, come on, you know. It wasn't like I went in with open scabs and stuff. I waited till the scabs were all healed before I went to get my hair cut because it sort of looked like it had been done by a weed eater because the glass and whatnot had whacked it up so bad. And, you know, so I did wait until I was, you know, pretty much healed up and just to the scar, vivid scarring stage. And, you know, I became really good at wearing makeup, even though I'd never worn it before. And to be honest, I don't wear it anymore, but to cover the scarring, because people reacted so bad. I couldn't find, I wanted to change jobs at that point, change fields I was working in. People wouldn't hire me. I couldn't get clerks to wait on me. I mean, it was really, it was, you know, kind of tough on the ego.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it kind of did wake me up to being a little bit more considerate to other people, because we are. It's like we are afraid of anyone who isn't attractive or physically capable or whatever. And we see the same thing with elderly people. You know, as we age and become less capable, we're seeing where once again, you sort of what like I went through after the car accident, people start doing that again because you're old and slow and maybe your teeth clack funny and your hands shake and whatnot. People try to avoid looking at you or paying attention to you, and you become part of the furniture.
Right, right. I know, and it's so sad because, you know, everybody on the planet has something to offer, or they wouldn't be here. You know, I really, really, that. I really, truly believe that we're all here because we have a unique gift or unique ability to contribute something. And I really believe that we would be a much richer society if we would honor every individual and look for what it is that they're here to teach us. You know, if we could do that rather than sort of fall back into our judgment, we would be so much richer. You know, when you look at the cultures of old, you know, when you look at, for example, and you know, even today, Native American culture, for example, the elders are revered. In India, also, the elders are revered. You know, Ram Dass, I read something that Ram Dass had written where he said that he's an American man. For those who don't know, Ram Dass was an American man that was spiritually educated in India. I don't personally know a lot about him, but I read an excerpt of something that he had written where he, as he aged, he had not been to India for quite a while, and he went back, and he, when he went back, his hair was white, and his friends that he hadn't seen in a very long time greeted him and said, "Wow, you look so old." And to them, that was a compliment. Their culture, that was a compliment. Because now he had joined the ranks of the revered elders. But to his American mind, it was like a slap in the face to be told that, wow, you look old. So, you know, again, it's a matter of filtering. It's a matter of interpretation. But I think that we really sort of sell ourselves short, and we miss opportunities when we don't look at each person as an individual gift and see them instead as something scary or uncomfortable. The other thing is that the other reason I really believe that people do that, where they back off, don't make eye contact, try and ignore anyone who's a little bit different, is because it reminds them of their own frailty. It reminds them that, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
It really reminds them, and it scares the hell out of people to think, wow, that could happen to me. You know, there's a saying, I'm not sure if it's a joke or not, you know, most sayings are based in truth, and that is that the disability minority is the only minority that anybody can join at any time.
Yeah.
You know, we are a non-discriminatory minority. You know, anyone could become part of us at any given time. And that scares the hell out of people. But it's truth. You know, we are all very frail. We are all, you know, one slip away from dealing with these issues ourselves, and that's scary. And because it's scary, people back off and look the other way.
Yeah, that's very true. And yeah, I often make jokes in my own case. Anything that I exhibited less tolerance than maybe I should have in the past, I've gotten to enjoy personally. So I'm making a habit of being pretty tolerant of just about everything these days because, you know, I really don't want any more things to try out for myself. Yeah, even right down to migraines. I used to think that people with migraines were, you know, somewhat malingering. Surely a headache wasn't that bad. Well, after the car accident, I got to try out some, you know, mega migraine situations and was plagued with them for years. You know, I know now that when somebody says, I have a migraine, they can, you know, mean a great deal of agony and inability to function. And so, you know, learning firsthand about things has kind of educated me a little bit along the way. But not everybody goes through that kind of education process. And not every knows somebody who's become disabled. And so when they themselves or someone close to them becomes disabled, it can be very difficult for them to cope.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you talked about that grieving process. You know, I know that in dealing with the medical doctors, that was not something that was addressed by most of my doctors. My current general practitioner does, but most of the doctors that I dealt with, specialists and whatnot, never addressed the psychological ramifications of dealing with the chronic pain and the disability issues. And, you know, that's probably most people's case.
Right.
So, you know, what kind of resources are there really available for people when they are facing those, you know, you might say side effects of your disabilities?
Well, here's the sad truth. We've become sort of the conveyor belt kind of medical society where, you know, everybody's piece is so specialized that they and they're timed. You know, doctors have to see a certain number of patients per hour. Otherwise, their clinic typically docks them. They get in trouble. So they've got to crank them out as quickly as, and so they deal with the most prominent issues, and they send them down the conveyor belt, and then the physical therapist just deals with whatever the issues are, the occupational therapist, whatever. Each specialty just does their little piece, and then they move on. And I think my observation is that there's really no bad intent in all of that. It's just a lack of understanding of the system and perhaps a presumption that the next phase will deal with that because I don't have time. And what ends up happening is that people, and I used to see this time after time after time as a vocational counselor, I would get people into my office and they would be just an emotional mess because nobody talked with them about the grief process. Nobody talked with them about the coping skills. Nobody talked to their family about dealing with the stresses and why they're seeing personality changes in their partner and, you know, how they need to take care of their own issues and their own needs as well as being more compassionate for their partner and on and on and on. These things were just not dealt with. So, what we say to people is, look, first of all, you need to find a good counselor, and you need to interview them before you work with them, because what you want is someone who specializes in grief. If you can't find someone who specializes in grief easily, keep looking and expand your search, because if they don't get grief, they're not going to be helpful for you. And really what this is, you know, as an example, I had a client with a very severe physical injury that pretty much sidelined her life, as well as it, you know, it limited her physically, and it came with chronic pain. And she went to a counselor who basically said, "You're being a baby. Get over it and get on with it." well, that's not helpful. And I, you know, she came to me and said this, and I was like, wow, you know, to me that's malpractice. I was horrified that someone would say that. And I said to her, you know, you can't get over it and get on with it until you grieve it. I would say to her and all of my clients, there is light at the end of the tunnel. There is life after death, and it doesn't have to suck. I know this firsthand. But you have to go through the stages. You have to go through this slowly. You have to process what you've been through so that you can get to that side, so that you can get to sort of rebuilding your new life. So I would say to anybody who's going through this, interview counselors who can be supportive and who specialize in grief and loss to help you as you move through any disability adjustment that you have to move through. That is really, I think, a crucial component of healing, because really what we're talking about is healing. You know, we're talking about dealing with whatever the issue is, and then healing through it so that you can rebuild your life.
Yeah, you know, I know that as I've gone through this process, I've had to learn to scale things back, okay? You know, I'm never going to backpack the Appalachian Trail or the Pacific Crest Trail. Those things aren't going to happen. I am planning a backpacking trip. But I've scaled it back to where this is accessible, and I found ways to cope with the fact that I can't carry a full backpack anymore. You know, because when you actually start,
things that, you know, you can use in the kitchen to do things one-handed, and, you know, they're out there. We don't have to keep reinventing the wheel. So
sometimes your solutions are real simple. I had some half-sheet baking pans, and I had my husband cut fat dowel. I prefer a dowel-like or just a tube. And so we went and got fat dowels, and he cut them. And one goes the wide port or distance of the pan, and the other one goes the narrow distance. I roll out things in that pan. A, it makes it really easy for cleanup because I can just take it to the sink. B, the rolling pin doesn't get away from me. And I've got one size for each one. I can roll out things to my heart's content now, one-handed. And nothing gets away from me. Real
right.
Simple solution.
Right. And you can get, so that your pan doesn't slip around, you can get Dysom. And Dysom is I don't know if you know about Dysom. Dysom is a wonderful, rubbery kind of thing that you put on your counter. And they typically use it in nursing homes so that people, elderly people, when they're eating and, you know, they don't have their plates slipping around on them. So it's kind of this rubbery thing. You put it down, you put your pan on it. Your pan isn't going to go anywhere now because it's not a slippery surface. Now it's a rubbery surface they put, and you can get Dysom. You can go to any occupational therapy clinic. They have it on rolls. You can tell them what you need. They'll charge you a few bucks. And it's an easy, easy fix.
Uh-huh.
So there's so many cool things out there. It's just so important to network and find out so that you don't frustrate yourself by trying to figure everything out on your own. The other thing that you said that's really important is having a backup plan. As someone who grew up with a disability, I've been doing this my whole life. I always plan ahead. So if I'm going to a new building, I will call ahead. I'll find out, are you accessible? Where's the accessible entrance? What do I have to do? You know, I mean, this is just a normal way of life for me. When I'm nervous about something, and I have this in my book, I play the what if game. So let's say I'm thinking about, maybe I want to go on a trip. And then I start thinking, okay, what if this happens? What if that happens? And I plan it all out in my mind to that degree. Like, okay, if this were to happen, I could do that. So I already have backup plans in my brain. I've sort of anticipated potential issues, and I've already thought of potential solutions so that it reduces my anxiety, and it makes me able to, be prepared so that if I think, well, gosh, what if I go there and I physically can't do it without help? Well, maybe I should bring a buddy along just in case. And so rather than go somewhere by myself and then find out that I'm stuck or that I've really lost the energy and now I just don't have the energy to drive back home, you know, maybe I'm in another city at a workshop or something, and now I'm like, oh man, I'm exhausted and I don't know if I can drive home. I have thought that through and I have a buddy with me so that if I am too tired to drive, my buddy already knows that, I'm gonna lean on them. Or maybe I'll drive there knowing that I'm gonna be tired when I come back and my buddy already knows, okay, you drive there, I'll drive back. So it's that kind of pre-planning that I think keeps us safe, for one thing, and number two, it sort of relieves anxiety. And I think the other thing that you said that's really important is asking for help. We are, unfortunately, we're a society that is fiercely independent, and sometimes that's good. Sometimes it's just arrogant. You know, I mean, normal communities, or not normal, healthy rely on each other. Healthy communities rely on their neighbors. People offer to help one another. You know, that's the way it was years ago. You know, neighbors would help neighbors, and it wasn't such a bad thing to ask for help. You know, in farming communities, people help each other just as a matter of course because, you know, if I help you, then when my crops are ready, then you're going to help me. And that's kind of the way we do it. So, unfortunately, we've gotten sort of arrogant in our independence. And then when we need to ask for help, it comes as a blow when really it's sort of a healthier way of living. Because just like you said, when you ask for help, other people get to learn from you and you from them. You know, we I think are healthier when we are interdependent rather than independent. I think interdependence fosters community and independence sort of fosters arrogance, I think. Now again, this is the world according to Dinah, but you know, it's just my observation after watching for my whole life, because for me, I grew up having to ask for help. So when I would see my clients suffering because they had to ask their kid to take the garbage out, that was a whole new thing for me. I was like, wow, really? Because I've asked for help my whole life. And when they told me that it was hard for them, I tried to put myself in their shoes and tried to understand. And I thought, wow, okay, that's just something that people who are not disabled don't do really well. And gosh, I think that's kind of sad, because as I've asked for help, I've met really cool people. I've opened doors. You know, I've had good experiences by having to ask people for help. I've really never had anybody, or at least not in it, that come to mind easily. I really haven't had bad experiences when I've asked people for help. They've usually either been neutral or very positive. So I think it can be a really good thing if we can look at it as our own teaching tool and a teaching tool for the people we're asking as well.
Yeah, you know, recently we bought an old house, and, you know, in the process of moving in and trying to get things updated and whatnot, when I was setting up my time frame, it was actually kind of a wake-up call here recently, because as I was setting up the time frame for doing things, I forgot all the problems that I was going to be facing. You know, I really did. I forgot about my own limitations. I forgot about the way time works for me getting things done now. And I was doing it as though it was 20 years ago, and I could just pop out stuff and nothing flat. So, you know, when all the stuff arrived, I was not ready for it to get here. So now I've got boxes and boxes and boxes. And, you know, it became overwhelming, you know, and then you're feeling bad because you didn't get things done, as though you were being somehow negligent and so forth and so on. And then finally, you just, you know, I kind of had a conversation with myself. I do that a lot, you know, which maybe is a sign of dementia of some sort. But I do have conversations with myself a lot about dealing with things. I'm like, look, you know that you're doing the best that you can. And okay, so you didn't get things done as quickly as you thought you should have. Fine, you know, let's just go on. And, you know, in addition, I've called on my daughter to say, okay, look, I really, really need some help with some of these things because I just can't do them, and they're not things that my husband is going to be really good at, which, like, organizing the kitchen and stuff like that. It's just not really exactly his forte. I would rather have her help because she knows exactly what I need because, first of all, she grew up, you know, and with me having a kitchen and whatnot. And, you know, I taught her a lot of things about cooking as she was growing up. So she knows, you know, what kinds of things I'm going to be facing. But it's also an opportunity for her to learn about the new issues I'm facing, which is things like, okay, those shelves are too high for me, so they need to have things on them that I don't have to get very often because it's now a long, drawn-out process of getting out the step stool, setting it up, getting the thing out of the cupboard, setting it on the counter, one piece at a time. You know, I don't want to have to deal with this very often. So things need to be down lower and up higher. You know, there's less usable distance in a kitchen for me now than there used to be. And kitchens really are, and I'm sure you've encountered it too, kitchens are not designed for people who have kind of an issue.
No, not at all. I hear everything you're saying, and I totally get it.
Yeah, yeah. So she's going to come and help me. And this kitchen was designed in 1948.
Cool.
So really kind of, you know, not only is it kind of peculiar in some ways, things like cupboards are very shallow shelves. I mean, strange shelves. You know, so containers don't fit in them and whatnot. So we're going to have to do some... And I'm fortunate in that my husband is good at building things, so he will make me some cupboard things to go on the opposite wall, blank wall, that will make up for the fact that so much of the kitchen's unusable for me because of the way it's designed. So, you know, I'm lucky in that. But, you know, when you look at what's commercially available, a lot of times if you just kind of do some creative thinking and... shopping and walking around and talking to other people, you can find commercially available things that are standalone furniture that you can, you know, add to your household to make things a little bit easier. Because overhead cabinets are very difficult for me, so are ones that you practically have to stand on your head to access.
Mm-hmm.
And those are common issues. Those are the same issues that you reach as you age, too. Because I remember my grandmother talking about them and so forth and so on.
You know, I can tell you, just as another resource for your listeners to think about, every state receives federal funds to have independent living centers strategically located throughout their state. So if you Google independent living centers in your state, you should come up with several. And the people at these independent living centers are meant to be independent advisors for people with disabilities. They, according to the federal funds, I believe they have to be 55% staffed by people with disabilities so that you don't have non-disabled people thinking that they know what they're doing, and that's not a cut to people without disabilities. Many of them are very compassionate and very educated in their field, and they know a lot about what they're doing. So it's not a cut on people without disabilities, but there is a certain amount of understanding and rapport building that can be a whole lot easier when you're talking disability to disability. When you're talking to someone who has experienced what you've experienced. And when they set up these independent living centers, they understood that. So they have to be, again, I think I'm right here, that they have to be at least 55% staffed by people with disabilities. And you can go to these places, and you should be able to get a lot of answers to you. So, for example, let's say you're building a home, and you want to build an accessible home. They should be able to guide you toward getting plans that you can look over and get some basic concepts for what to include in your home to make it accessible. Or let's say you're somebody who really needs more support in your home. Maybe you need home health aides to come in and help you with some of your activities of daily living. These people should be able to help you find out who the agencies are that are good and reliable, how it can be funded, you know, if there's available funding to you, how to get on that funding or at least on the waiting list for that funding. A lot of your questions as far as how can I make this work should be answered by people at independent living
centers. That's a very useful thing. In my particular case, I'm very fortunate in that my spouse sick, but he's very capable at helping me. I mean, initially he had to help me shower, get dressed, do my hair. Okay, he will never make a hairdresser. He tried, but I decided that my lopsided, because I have long hair and I typically wear it up. The lopsided way I could get it up on my own better than his best attempt. I keep telling him he's going to have to learn how to braid. But, you know, that's the one thing with, I cut off a lot of it for a time. It's now almost as long as it was when I got hurt. But for a long time, I did have it much shorter than it had been, because brushing it was something that I was having a lot of problems with. Washing it was very difficult. You know, and like I said, you know, I had to learn how to bathe by myself, get dressed, do my hair. I've never tried putting on makeup since I got hurt, so I don't know if I could successfully do that. I'm just not really crazy about the makeup. I think the years of feeling like I had to wear it to keep people from staring. Now, eventually, I was fortunate, okay? I'm one of those people that doesn't scar real badly. So once the red and the skin leveled out so it was even and whatnot, they're really not that visible anymore. But I was told that I will age more rapidly than I would have had I not had my face so badly cut up. So we'll wait and see. You know, I'm now on the far side of 50, so, you know, the wrinkles are going to be coming rapidly, I guess, now. But I'm not real worried about that particular issue. It's several years before I got hurt, I'd given up the hair dye thing. So my hair is now a natural gray, which some people think makes me look older, but I guess I decided I was going to celebrate the fact that I've survived this long.
Right.
You know, it's just I just didn't see any reason for it anymore. It was aggravating. It was frustrating. My hair happens to grow really rapidly, so I, you know, every 10 days I had the what I call the Cruella de Vil look, with the silver roots showing, and with long hair it was just So I did. I decided, okay, I've had enough of this. I'm not doing it anymore. Let's celebrate the fact that, you know, we have gotten older, and so my hair is more gray than other people my age or even in my own family, because I have a number of people that have reached 100 with less gray hair than I've got now. So, you know, that's just the way it is. I've had gray hair through my hair since childhood, so now I have lots of gray hair. And it's funny because my husband happens to be someone who has an extremely youthful appearance, especially when he's doesn't have a beard. We make jokes that he looks like he could pass as a high school student. So people assume that he's my son. So, you know, as long as I keep a sense of humor about it, it's very amusing. There's days when, you know, we all have less humor than usual, and then it's like, ah! But, yeah, you know, I think a sense of humor really, really is probably my best asset in dealing with it, and I'm sure that's for other people, too. Learn to laugh and everything. You know, I can't undo that day that I got hurt. I can't go back and not have been there then doing that. You know, mine happened to be a freak accident. I got hurt picking up a 15-pound dog. Okay, you know, that was a freak thing. I have picked up 100-pound dogs and never been hurt. I just had a freak accident. And it was unfortunate, and it was, you know, in some ways very, very tragic, but in other ways it's forced me to grow as a person. And I think my natural optimism and tendency to laugh at things has really, really been the best things for me along the way. Because you do have to laugh about it. It's like, okay, you know, I don't drop things as often as I used to, but, you know, you would have these, I call them spaz attacks in my arm, and it, for me, it's like, imagine the most violent shivering you can possibly imagine and have it happen in just your arm, but you're not cold. Mm. And it just shivers. I mean, that's the only way I can describe it. And the doctors would look at me like I was crazy when I'm trying to describe it. And, you know, I was like, maybe I am imagining it. Well, until one day it did happen at physical therapy. And it's like, okay, this is what I'm talking about, you know. And she's like, oh, okay. There's not much we can do about it. You know, just learn to live with it. So it's like, okay, it's not painful, but it is unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
So you just, you have to laugh about things like that, or when, you know, it suddenly happens and stuff goes all over the floor. My dogs are excited if it's anything edible that does it, you know. Yeah, they're my best cleanup crew. You know, if it lands on the floor, they happily clean it up for me, unless it's onions, chopped onions. They're not crazy about chopped onions. But, you know, that you do. You have to learn to laugh about things, to just let things slide off of you sometimes.
Right, right. Well, yeah, for our own peace, and truly, I really believe that it's important for our own physiology that we be as peaceful as we can be, as, you know, as much of the time as we can manage. And, you know, one of the things that I've taught my sis, when I was younger, I had more of a temper. I got irritated much more quickly. And, you know, it's not to say that I don't know. I do still get irritated. But I've learned to ask myself most of the time, is it worth it? Is it, you know, in my head, before I start to escalate, you know, and I know exactly what you mean. You know, I'll drop something. And now picking things up is very challenging for me. It's very difficult for me to maintain my balance and right myself after I've tried to bend over to pick something up. So it's an exercise in frustration, if not futility, for me. So, you know, years ago, when I did that, I might drop something and then it might be followed by a series of really naughty words because I was like just so frustrated and so angry. And so, you know, this stream of filth might pour easily out of my mouth. And now I think, really, Donna, is it worth it? Do you really need to go there? Could you just take a deep breath and move on and, you know, and be okay with it? It's not the end of the world. It's not convenient, but it's not the end of the world. And so I've managed to interrupt my own escalation process. And by doing that, I think I've helped my own physiology. So, you know, I think what you're talking about, having a sense of humor, comes with that sort of ability to stay calm, stay in that place of acceptance, not overreact, and just keep moving on sort of a less of a roller coaster ride.
Yeah, you know, in my case, less often than the string of profanity is going to be tears of frustration. And I know when that happens, just walk away from whatever it is. Let it be. I don't care if it's a mess. I don't know, whatever. If I've reached that point, walk away from it, let it go, and, you know, come back to it later.
Yeah.
You know, because I really don't have any option. If I continue, I'm just going to make a bigger mess or have bigger problems. So, you know, yeah, I have to walk away from it. But, folks, on that note, it's time for us to take a break. So hold on to your keyboard and don't move a muscle. We're going to take this short break, and we'll be right back with more from Dinah Federer. To the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and tonight we are talking with Dinah Federer. And before we get started, Dinah, would you like to remind everyone to take a moment and take a look at your website while they're listening to the program tonight?
Yeah, I would love to. Please go to www.chasing-normal.net. Our website recently moved from .com to .net. So it's chasing-normal.net, and we would love your feedback.
Great, great. And it's a wonderful asset. Tonight we've been talking about coping with being disabled, especially for the newly disabled, which is what your book, Chasing Normal, is all about. You know, the coping mechanisms that people use are really, really important. See, can you give us some highlights maybe on what to look at for coping mechanisms?
Well, in my opinion, in order to cope, we need to be peaceful within. You know, as long as we are struggling within, it's pretty hard to cope. And, you know, the thing that I used to say when I was in the thick of my acquired disability, when I was dealing, what I have is trigeminal neuralgia, and I have it on both sides, which the term for that is bilaterally. I have bilateral trigeminal neuralgia. And what it is a nerve condition, that, causes, stabbing pains in the face. The trigeminal nerve is the facial nerve. It's also the nerve that contributes to migraines. When the trigeminal nerve starts going bad, it often feels like someone is just repeatedly stabbing you. It's electrical shocks that you get in your face, forehead, in your eyes, in your mouth, and it's like torture. It's no notified diseases.
I can understand that. I was diagnosed with that a year ago, and I described it as it feels like someone has taken a hot poker, jabbed it into my cheekbone, and is simultaneously using a rusty spoon to dig out my eye.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it is torture. And when I was in the thick of the pain of that, I would say to people, I don't have much elasticity in my personality today. I can't stretch very far, so don't mess with me. And you know, and I think that's kind of a common place where we all tend to go back and forth into when we feel like life is just stretching us to the breaking point. Hopefully we don't live there. Hopefully we just visit there periodically and we can figure out how to come back out of that. And I do in my own life. I kind of visit that place of being stretched too thin, and I pull myself back out of it as quickly as I can. And the way that I personally do that is I try and get to a place of acceptance. When I'm my most miserable, it's because I am wanting things to be different than they are. And when I am not accepting what's around me, when I am sort of doing this internal fight about how it's so wrong and it's not okay and why should I have to tolerate this and on and on and on, you know, that's me spiraling into negativity, and it just continues to build on itself. And I actually have been in a period like that just because of some external stressors that have just continued to sort of come in without any kind of a break. And I once again sort of had to pull myself in, rein myself in, and say, no, wait a minute. You know, the challenge here is to be peaceful with what is, not to be crazy about why it's not okay. It doesn't matter that it's not okay. It is. And I need to get okay with that. So I feel like acceptance, when we can get to a place, and we're not saying that it's okay. I really, you know, when I talk about acceptance, there's nothing okay about trigeminal neuralgia. There's nothing okay about the loss of functioning. It's not okay. In a perfect world, we wouldn't have that. And we would all be healthy, and, you know, it would all be great. But as a friend of mine said when he dealt with bladder cancer, nobody gave me any promise that I was going to be healthy or perfect for my whole life. I didn't come into this life with any guarantees. So
yeah, just like our kids don't arrive with a warranty, we didn't have one ourselves, you know.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, his statement when he was dealing with bladder cancer really was an eye opener for me. I thought, wow, you know, I didn't come in with any guarantees either. So I'm not saying that we need to our challenges is okay. We don't need to say it's okay. But we need to be able to look at it and say, all right, I can't change this, so I'm going to figure out a way to incorporate it into my life and grow with it rather than allow it to beat me. So I think that's part of coping, is learning to accept and say, all right, this is my life now, this is my reality now, how can I continue to grow? How can I continue to give back? How can I continue to serve my family or my community or my friends? How can I keep being somebody that keeps giving back? You know, I have a friend, I don't know if she's listening today, I have a dear friend in California who has multiple disability issues that she deals with. Excuse me. And she deals with chronic pain. She deals with many issues that have really limited her ability to interact with the world. And she handles things with such grace because she figures out a way to support other people even though she has so much on her own shoulders. You know, she's been a wonderful support to me, just in daily email communication. She's the supportive of her other friends through email. Talking is difficult for her because she too has trigeminal neuralgia, and in her case, talking is a trigger. And so she's really unable to do much communicating verbally, but she is a wealth of support and humor. And, you know, she can make me laugh when I am just about feeling like I'm 6 feet under. She can still make me laugh. So, you know, she's somebody that despite all the stuff that she carries on her shoulders, she continues to give back. And she gives back in meaningful ways. And I think that is a really important coping strategy. How can we deal with our disability? How can we continue to grow as a human being, and how can we give back? And when we look at those things, I think we're on the road to recovery.
Yeah, the giving back thing is kind of such a huge issue because, for one thing, part of being disabled often means at least a change in career, if not loss of your chosen field of work altogether. And, you know, trying to make sure that you still feel like you have something to give to the world is important for a form of self-validation, because, like I said, we identify with our work a great deal in this country. So you need to redefine who you are to still feel like you are a valuable citizen, that you're not just, you know, a drain on the economy, a drain on society in general, that you are still contributing. And for me, it was important to realize, okay, you know, even though I can't do things as far, as long, or as much as I used to, I still know how to do these things. And if I do them in smaller pieces, I can still teach somebody else how to do them or coach them through doing it if I can't physically do it anymore, and let them learn how to do this. And that was really important for me, and that's true for everybody. We all have skills of some kind, and, you know, passing on those skills can go a long ways towards helping us feel validated as people.
Exactly.
And members of society.
Exactly. You know, when I was contemplating whether or not I could continue with my job, my disability was worsening. I just was really having difficulty keeping up with the 40-plus hour week that I had been working for over 20 years. And I knew that my days were limited. I knew that I wouldn't be able to keep up that pace much longer. For me, the wake-up call was I was at work. I had gotten there before 7 in the morning. I had been seeing people and working on the computer and hadn't taken a break. And when I realized at 1:30 that I had not stood up, I hadn't even gone to the bathroom since I got to work, I thought, wow, this is not healthy. I need to get up. And I stood up, and I didn't know if my legs would carry me to the bathroom. And I thought, wow, you know, if you are, like, so overwhelmed that you can't get up and get to the bathroom a few times is not good. And that day, I had difficulty getting out to my van. I had difficulty walking into the house. And I realized that, again, that my days were numbered at work. And I really had to start thinking about it and thinking about, if I'm not a vocational counselor anymore, what am I? Because that's how I define myself. I loved my job. I loved my clients. I loved the work that I did. And when I realized that I was going to lose that part of my identity, I really had to give it some thought and think, okay, if I'm not a vocational counselor, what am I? Who am I? And I wrestled with that for quite a while. I really had to do some processing. I had to do some grieving. I had to really sort of take a look at, gosh, you know, then I had another wake-up call where I thought, how sad that I define myself by my job. I'm so much more than a job. You know, I'm a person that has certainly lots to offer in my job, but if I don't have my job, I'm still a worthwhile person. And I think we all need to, I think, be more mindful of that, that we are more than our jobs, we're more than our label, we're more than even what we give ourselves credit for. And again, the first step toward healing is to start giving ourselves credit for who we are and what we have to offer. And we have more to offer than just our job. We like you said, we can teach other people, we can volunteer, we can read to the elderly, we can volunteer at a soup kitchen, we can go to the Humane Society and, you know, play with some of the dogs, get them out of their cages, get some of the cats out of their cages, give them the love that they're craving. We can give back in a million different ways. We don't have to stop living just because we may need to stop working. And I think that's really, again, a crucial step toward healing.
Even, okay, and this may sound a little strange, but a lot of the process that someone goes through in terms of their work when they become disabled and unable to work, a person goes through a lot of the same issues when they retire.
Right.
Because there again, we've identified ourselves, defined ourselves by our job, and now retired. You know, many of us have seen people who literally seem to just sit down and wait to die when they no longer were working. And, you know, the same thing happens with people who become suddenly disabled and can no longer work, especially if they're older, because they just fail to redefine who they are.
That's right. And I think it's sad. But, you know, this is about choices. And I think we give ourselves permission to make the choice. You know, we need to choose better. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine once, and the words just slipped out of my mouth, where she was saying something that I found to be sort of victim oriented. And before I realized what was out of my mouth, it was out anyway, and I don't regret it, but I think it's really true. I said to her, being a victim is a choice. Choose better. And I really believe that we have to choose better. We have these choices in front of us. We can choose to live our lives differently. You know, this isn't about dying. This isn't about giving up. This is about living differently. So we can choose to live differently, or we do have the choice to just sit in the chair and give up and wait for death. But, you know, in my mind, that's a really long, slow, painful process, when we could instead be out engaging and enjoying to whatever capacity we're capable of, enjoying life, rather than just sitting around and becoming part of the furniture.
Right. And, you know, there's many ways, too, that, you know, the things that you can learn, taking hints from other people or your own experience. For me, when I'm having a really, really bad day, you know, the kind of days when, this is going to sound strange, there are days when, due to chronic pain, you may sit there and literally shake and sweat, and the pain becomes your entire world.
Right.
And don't ask me to do anything at that point. I mean, I can't talk to anybody. Don't ask me for anything. I cannot. I'm doing all I can do just to cope with this. Don't ask for anything else from me. And I found that there isn't anything that's going to make it go away. So the only thing I could do was find something to distract myself. In my particular case, it was, what my husband calls plinky games, repetitive video game where you didn't have to do anything other than, you know, click to match things or whatever. Something sort of mindless for me became a coping mechanism to deal with, you know, really intense pain times. And it didn't require a great deal of thought, but it required just enough to sort of help distract me from what I was going through at that time. I said nothing was going to make it go away. I had to find something that worked for me to distract me from the pain enough to sort of give me that little extra oomph of cope. And for me, that worked. It doesn't work for everybody. That particular thing worked for me. Other people may find something like crocheting or watching TV or listening to music or reading their Bible or, you know, saying their prayers, reciting poetry, singing themselves. You know, there's 101 things that you might choose to help you sort of find that place where it's not so bad.
Right. Chronic pain, you know, chronic pain, I think, is probably one of the biggest challenges anybody can face in their lifetime. Chronic pain is exhausting. It's depressing. It's depleting. Chronic pain is, it's sort of an entity in and of itself that we have to cope with at times. And when we have it, I think you're absolutely right. You have to find what works for you. When I was in the thick of it, I went through several months of nonstop trigeminal pain, day and night. And I was in that same place where at that point, giving back, you know, you have to be kind of stable within yourself before you can give back. And when you're in chronic pain, you're not in a place where you can go out and volunteer because you're just trying to stay alive. So when you're in that place, you really need to honor that and be really gentle with yourself. When I was in that place, when I was in that place of pain, I would say to people, I'm really frail right now. I'm very, very frail. I just can't take a lot. Please be gentle with me. Because I just felt like glass that could break at any moment. And I would either watch movies, you know, mindless movies that I knew had a happy ending. That was kind of the prerequisite. I had to know it had a happy ending or I wasn't interested. I didn't need anything else heavier in my life. Or I got into a binge where for a while I was just reading Harry Potter books because the Harry Potter series is pretty light and, you know, and pretty entertaining, and I didn't have to think a lot. And, you know, I think we just need to honor those places within ourselves. And when we are frail and when we are fragile, when we're at that fragile point, we need to honor that fragility, and we need to be kind to ourselves and do what brings us some measure of peace until the pain passes.
You know, at first, when I'd be dealing with it, I felt selfish because I would say, okay, I can't deal with anything. You know, all I'm caring about right now is me, because that's all I have time to care about is me. We're not raised to be selfish and self-centered like that. But what I've learned over time is when I am at that place where I have to be like that, if I don't, if I try to push it off and to be what other people think I should be, it becomes worse. You know, I can't do it to begin with. I just can't do it. I become very unpleasant to be around real quickly. You know, it's counterproductive. So I learned that for me to choose to be selfish now means that tomorrow might be a better day, or an hour from now might be just fine. You know, and for me, it didn't matter if it was on the phone, in person, whatever. Don't ask me for anything. Don't ask me to talk to you. Don't ask me to do anything. You know, and you know, so maybe some people may find it strange I do this radio program. I've considered myself fortunate that there have been very few occasions where I had to bow out of the radio program because of my own issues. But there have been a few times when somebody else has stepped in and hosted the show because I was in one of those times when I had to be selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's not selfish. I don't think it's selfish. I think it's self-care.
Yeah,
you know,
because nobody else can do this for me.
Right.
I mean, nobody else can go through the pain for me. Nobody else can deal with my internal issues that way, you know, in that way. Nobody else can, you know, carry it for me at all. I have to do it. And, you know, there are times when that's all I can do.
Right. And I think it becomes a point, again, where we need to make wise choices. And when you know that you're in that place where you just feel, again, feel fragile and need to engage in self-care, I think the wise choice is to do exactly that and to preserve what little energy you have so that you have that energy to deal with the pain and then to move forward from there. Because if you don't, the more depleted you get, the worse the pain gets.
Right. And a lot of people don't realize that, especially with chronic pain, stress really can compound it in, you know, mass that makes rabbit reproduction look like nothing. You know, and it's little things, like heat is a stress for me. And, you know, I live in the South, so camping being a favorite thing to do, I can't go camping when the weather's warm because the heat is too much of a stress. That, you know, the realization, you know, because I tried it one time, and I finally had to, you know, I came home a day early. It was supposed to be a two-day trip, and I came, I said, you know what, this isn't fun for me. I am not happy. I am not comfortable, and I'm really, really miserable, and I think it's best if we just call it quits, which is something that goes against my nature, usually, to call it quits. But that was the realization of you know, I need to have a plan B.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was the first time I had to say, look, this isn't fun. There's nothing about this that is fun or comfortable or pleasant. I am really, really miserable, and I want to kill somebody, and I think it's best if I just go home.
Right.
And, you know, and it was. It was much better that I just called it quits, went home. Everybody else could have a good time, and I could get where I was, you know, comfortable again. And, you know, the little, because I talked to the doctor about it, and I said, why is it, you know, a hangnail suddenly puts me in a position where I want to kill? And he's like, it's stress. And, you know, any little thing is too much for you.
Right.
And it makes it worse. So you're going to have to pick and choose your, because nobody has a stress-free life, okay? This doesn't happen. But you can learn to pick and choose what you're going to deal with in terms of stress. For me, it was like, okay, heat and camping means no fun, so why go there? You know, just don't do that. So I don't go camping in the summertime anymore. I go because I cope with cold. Cold is okay, you know. I know ways to stay warm. But that heat in a tent is just sheer misery.
Mm-hmm.
Or even in a hammock, any place I've tried. It was not fun. I was miserable. And for me, that was just okay, over the top. Now, other people, they may find that cold makes them over the top. But in my case, it happens to be heat that does it. So, you know, you learn to pick and choose your stressors to find that place of peace.
Right. And I think as we go through that process, I would encourage people to be really gentle with themselves when they find that out. Because sometimes you don't know what you don't know, if that makes sense. You know, you tend to relate to the world the way you always did in your pre-disability state. So you go out and you try something, and you're in the middle of it, and you find out, oh my gosh, I can't do this anymore. I used to be able to do this, but I can't do it anymore. And then the natural chain of events would be to berate yourself, belittle yourself, you know, really just make yourself feel terrible because you failed, and who has trouble with this, what's wrong with me, and on. And by doing that, all you're doing is depleting what little reserves you have left. Instead, if you could say, I didn't realize I can't do that anymore. Now I'm a little smarter. And now I can sort of gauge my next experience based on this one, and I'll know what to do differently. You know, to really change your self-talk, you know, that voice in our heads that we all have that is so quick to judge. And in my book, I talk about that we have the inner critic that says, what's wrong with you? You used to be able to do that. Shame on you. you know, it's your own fault. You let yourself go, and now look what happened, and on and on and on. You know, I went through that. I still go through it a little bit, where, you know, because I have two disabilities, when I was dealing with the trigeminal, they gave me a medication that made me really, really weak. And they didn't really think it through. They didn't realize what the medication would do to somebody with my neuromuscular disease. So I'm on this medicine, and, you know, I could walk, okay, and then I took the medicine, and I couldn't walk. And I didn't walk I could maybe just make it to the bathroom and back to the chair. And I was like that for about a week until the drug got out of my system. And, you know, my inner critic at that point was like having a field day telling me what a loser I was because all of a sudden I was so weak and, you know, shame on me, that kind of thing. And I really had to sort of reach deep inside and think, all right, enough. You don't get to talk anymore. You know, like, I am done listening to that part, that negative part of myself. And in the book, I suggest to people that you turn your inner critic into an inner coach. Because really, instead of berating yourself, what would be better is for your inner coach to say, wow, look at how smart you just got. Now you realized that you can't camp in summer. Now you know you have to camp in the fall or the winter or the spring. You're a lot smarter than you were a week ago. Good for you. And now you can plan differently. You can plan events that are more good for you. You're a wiser woman now. You know, those are the kind of things that we need to be sort of teaching ourselves to say internally rather than berating ourselves, because who needs that?
Right. You know, I often, I've been telling myself a lot over the past few years is, you know, be as nice to yourself as you would be to a stranger.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. And if I would not berate a stranger for that, then why am I berating myself?
Exactly.
You know, so, you know, you have these internal conversations. For me, learning to say, okay, this is not working. I need to stop trying to make this work because it's not going to get any better. That was a turning point for me. Once I learned, okay, nothing horrible is going to happen because I quit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are times when quitting is the smarter thing to do. It's like, okay, if we're banging our head on a wall and it starts to hurt, we stop. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that makes sense to us. So why am I trying to do something that is not working and continuing to try to do it when essentially it is the same as standing and banging my head on a brick wall?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing better, you know, nothing's going to change about it. You know, and I'm not saying to not try. I'm saying, you know, evaluate it honestly. You know, I know that I don't do well when it's hot and I cannot cope with it during the day. But if I can't sleep because of heat, or I can't cool down during bouts of pain, I become really, really hot and I sweat a lot. And if I can't cool down then, you know, things deteriorate rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for me, that was an important thing to realize and to come up with methods of coping. And I've gotten a lot better at it. Am I perfect at it? No. But, you know, it is something that, you know, I do realize and accept now. And that was an important part was, you know, I'm not a wimp just because I can't take the heat, okay? It's just the South never cools down. When summer comes, it just stays hot. It's hot at night, it's hot in the daytime, it's hot and humid. That's just the way it is. And as long as I continue to live here, that's the way it's going to be. So, you know, it is something you individual people have individual things. You talked about triggers with your trigeminal neuralgia. I love to be outdoors, but a trigger for me happens to be a breeze. Doesn't matter if it's hot or cold. Doesn't matter if it's from a fan, an air conditioning unit, or the natural breeze outside. When the trigger starts working, I have to make sure that a breeze can't hit that side of my face. And for me, it's a scarf. And, you know, when you wrap up your face, where one side of your face is entirely covered with a scarf, of course people think that this be Muslim or something like that, and it's like, or you're trying to hide something or whatever. It's like, no, I'm just trying to get, you know, where I'm comfortable again, because for me it's really important to eliminate that trigger as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, individual people learn individual ways of coping. You know, and talking with your doctor, you know, there again, with your medication, you had an unsuccessful medication that was tried and it didn't work. If you hadn't talked to your doctor about the weakness, you could have been in serious physical trouble. You know, in my case, the first medication was... It had side effects that were not acceptable for me.
You know, and that's a really important part. I think we need to be really assertive with our doctors, because we know our bodies, and too many people sort of go to the doctor, put them on a pedestal, assume that they know everything, and just follow them blindly. And I think that's dangerous. You know, my point, and a point that I make in the book, is that a doctor is my employee. He is not doing me any favors. He is getting paid handsomely for his time with me. So since he's on my dime, he better be paying attention, and he better be doing his job. And if he's not, he's out, and I'll find someone who will do that kind of job, because I am the employer, they are the employee. And I had the doctor that gave me this drug, I called, and I left a message with the nurse, and I said, I can't walk, I need a different medication. And the doctor himself called me to tell me that that was absolutely wrong. And I said, it's not wrong. I could walk, and then I couldn't. And the only thing that's different in my life is this medicine. And he said, I am telling you that this medicine would not do that. And I said, really? How many people exactly with my neuromuscular disease have you given this drug to successfully? How many? And he said, I'm not going to argue with you. I said, no, you're not going to argue with me. You're going to give me a different medication, because I'm telling you what this one did. And he was very irritated with me, but he did give me a different medicine, and I was right. It was the medicine that was doing it. And believe it or not, it took me 20 years of telling various neurologists that these medicines were making me weak. And my neurologist that I had been working with quite regularly, he and his nurse had branded me as medication resistant. And at one point, you know, his nurse actually said that to me. She said, well, you know, you always have been medication resistant. And I looked at her and I said, no, actually, I'm just fond of getting up off the toilet by myself. And she sort of backtracked the room, because I think that offended her, which was actually my intention at that moment. But, you know, it took me 20 years to find a neurologist who said, well, that makes perfect sense. And he explained why that class of medicine would do that to me. So, you know, they don't all pay attention to the details as much as we would wish that they would. And I understand that, because they're very busy and their workload's very high. But then it becomes my responsibility to sort of keep them paying attention. And if they're not paying attention, if they're not double-checking, then I need to find someone who is and who will. So I really encourage everyone who is newly disabled, don't take what your doctor says at face value. If your body is telling you something else, dig deeper, ask more questions, get more opinions. When your body is telling you something, you know what you know, and don't let anybody else talk you out of what you know.
Exactly. And I actually told my doctor this the last time, because I recently moved, so now my doctor is like 90 miles away. I have no intentions of changing, and largely because this is what I told him. I said, I don't care if your doctor graduated from Harvard or the best medical school or whatever. I don't care what's on his wall. If you don't click with him, and he cannot give you good care. And you've got to be able to understand him, and he's got to be able to understand you. And if that relationship isn't there, I don't care what kind of education or skills he's got, or she, they're not going to be able to do the job that you need them to do.
Right. Right. I said to my neurologist, one of my neurologists, I've had many over the years, but one of them who was, he just wasn't plugging in. I said, three things you need to know about me. I'm not a bell ringer. I don't call you just for attention. I'm not a hypochondriac. And if I call you, it's because I've tried every other option that I can think of, every other alternative, because I prefer to go with the least amount of medication possible, because I'm very prone to side effects. So I said to him, the third thing is that when I call you, I've tried everything else that I can think of, and I have now gotten to my last option, which is you. So if I call you, you will take me seriously, and you will respond appropriately. These are the parameters for the job description. Accept them, or I'll move on.
Uh-huh.
And he said, oh. I mean, he literally sort of backed away from me in his chair and said, okay, I can work with that. I said, all right, then we'll move on together. But at that point, I was fully intending. I would have been fine either way. If he said, you don't get to talk to me like that, I would have said, okay, have a good day. And I would have left. Because again, I feel like I'm paying you, you're my employee. You know, plug in and pay attention.
Right. And, you know, there's that old joke about doctors are licensed to practice medicine.
Yeah. Exactly.
They haven't perfected it, obviously. So, you know, they don't know everything. And not all doctors are created the same. Not all doctors react the same way with each and every patient. You know, somebody that your sibling or your friend reacts really well to might not be the best person for you. And a lot of it is how personalities interact. And,
right.
You know, like I said, in my case, you know, I got one that I click with really well, and it's really nice to be able to talk to him, just tell him, you know, what's going on, you know, what my issues were with the medication that I was taking. In my case, the side effects happened to be as much psychological as they were physical. They were known side effects, it's just I was not coping well with them. And like, you know what, the disease isn't as bad as the side effects, okay? We've got to get something else, you know. So, you know, we're working on alternative solutions. Because for me, that just, it wasn't working. It was, as I put it to him, turning me into somebody that I don't even like. Mm-hmm. You know, and that, you know, I live with me 24 hours a day. So I better like me. And that's an important thing to remember. You got to like yourself. Take care of yourself, be concerned about yourself, and it's not being selfish, because if you are not at your best, you can't do anything for anybody else.
Right. Right. It's all about that whole theme of self-care. You know, if we don't do it, nobody's going to. So we have to be in charge of our own self-care. We have to be, and it's not narcissistic to be thinking along those lines. It's instead really a path to health when we can say, you know, for my own well-being, I need to, you know, I know I need to get this much sleep, or I know I need to have, you know, at least an hour of downtime during the day to sort of get myself back on track, or whatever it is that you need to stay healthy, that's appropriate. And it's good self-care to then work that into your lifestyle so that you can do it. It's not any different than a jogger that says they're going to jog 5 miles a day, 6 days a week. You know, if that's what they do to keep themselves healthy, great. You know, maybe I can't jog, but if I, you know, I know that if I don't get at least 7 hours of sleep, I'm going to be shaky and weak tomorrow. Well, then for my own health, I'm going to make sure that I get 7 hours of sleep a night. You know, it's not any different than other people do. It just looks different. And we have to be okay with that and engage in self-care anyway.
Right. You know, and the self-care ranges the whole thing from not only your medication and your medical care, but to make sure that you get enough rest, to make sure that you have that downtime, to find methods of coping. For me, it was really important. I feel really, really badly when my issues interfere with other people's fun. When that, you know, when I'm doing something with somebody and it turns out this wasn't a really bright idea for me, to be able to bow out without ruining the event or activity for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've learned to, you know, use your what if method to come up with ways, okay, if this isn't working for me, how can I get out of it without, you know, inconveniencing other people?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was important to learn how to do that or to make sure that I can do that, because it took away from my pleasure to feel like I had to finish it.
Right. Right.
You know, I might enjoy a half day of this or an hour of this, but I'm not going to enjoy a whole weekend of this. And I'm not going to be able to do a whole weekend of this. But I can do this, you know, in a smaller piece, you know, have an out during the course of the activity. So I will look at activities, you know, in those terms as well. The one thing I haven't tried yet that I still want to do is I wanted to go deep sea fishing. However, not only do I have physical issues, I happen to have a boat phobia. So I'm not real sure about this one yet. I haven't decided how I'm going to deal with that. But, yeah, you know, I've now managed to go out in small boats, you know, and fishing and whatnot. My phobia happened to be real specific about boats with motors, canoes and kayaks and that kind of stuff was fine. But paddling one is beyond me now. I did try that, and that was like, no. Between the balance issue and 'cause I tried it in a safe environment. You know, we were all fooling around at a lake, and I said, let me try this. I always wanted to do this. And, you know, stay right here in case I can't, because I also cannot swim anymore. And stay right here in case I can't, you know, manage this. And, you know, I tried it, and it was like I couldn't even balance in the kayak, you know, for me. So it was like, okay, I know that I need a different type, and as well as a two-man, so that somebody else can be with me that does most of the paddling. Okay, I could probably do it that way, but I can't use this particular type in this particular way. So it was like, okay, you know, that I was okay with that. I tried it. I found out, and you know, so I've pushed things as far as I can in some areas, and I think that's an important part of learning to cope.
Right. Right. Baby steps. You know, that old saying, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. You know, you know, in your case, I would suggest just by that, you know, I live near the Great Lakes. So, I know about it, like big bodies of water and big waves, and they can be quite daunting. So, you know, to get your feet wet, I would start with like a pontoon in a very calm lake, you know, at least then you'll be on a boat with a motor, but a pontoon boat is, you know, pretty big, pretty safe, pretty, you know, you're not going to be riding a lot of waves, hopefully, you know, starting very gradually and working slowly, bigger boats and bigger waves and that
kind
of thing.
Well, I've actually mastered the smaller boat thing. I go out in a fishing boat, and I've been to the point where you can see the open water of the Gulf. I haven't gone out in the Gulf itself. and I was okay with it. I didn't have any issues. I was okay with it. I will say that I'm really, like, goofy about the life jacket thing. I have a very fancy life jacket because learning that I couldn't swim at all was really scary for me because I wasn't a real fast swimmer, but I was what I always called a determined swimmer. I could swim a long distance because I knew, you know, how to, when you got tired, what you did, and then I could swim some more, and, you know. So I could swim across, like, a half-mile lake without any problem. So, you know, learning that I couldn't swim at all was, like, scary. And so you couldn't even tread water. So it was, the life jacket coped with that particular fear of mine. But yeah, you know, the deep sea fishing, I think my biggest thing is that, yeah, I'll get out there, discover this is the brightest idea I had, and, you know, somebody's going to have to take me back, and that's going to ruin their day. So, you know, one of these days I might try, you know, a ferry boat or something like that, where you go to a place and then you stop and you know, get a taste of it before I actually be one that goes out to one of the barrier islands from Biloxi and Gulfport area. So, yeah, baby steps, like you said, you know, and that's what we all do. You know, we learn to walk by entering a marathon, so why do we look at post-disabled life that way?
Right. Yeah, it's just one step at a time, and it's a constant, constant learning process. And I think as long as we really work hard to have that inner coach rather than the inner critic, you know, tell the inner critic to be quiet and work with our inner coach and say to ourselves what we would say to somebody else who is going through this. You know, that coach mentality or mentor mentality, good for you, keep going, you're smarter than you were before, you know, you've learned new things, you know, great job, whatever it is that you would say to somebody else, positive, say those same things to yourself every day.
Yeah. Adana, we are running out of time, so before we close, you want to tell everybody what your book title is and what your website is?
Yeah, Chasing Normal, A Guide for the Newly Disabled and for Those Who Love Them. You can find it either on Amazon or you can find it at www.chasing-normal.net, our new web location.
Okay. Well, this show has gone by all too quickly, as usual, folks, but I hope that it has given everyone plenty of food for thought as well as more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Tune in again next time as we bring another guest, another topic, and a whole new idea for your consideration. Tonight, you've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.